From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Would you prefer it if things always stayed the same?
I don't like change!
A lot of us feel that way, Stewie, but change is the only constant in life, to quote Greek philosopher Heraclitus. On today's show, we're going to talk about big changes that have come to one Georgia city and to the state's ecology as well. That's coming up this hour. First, though, I want to harken back to a couple of conversations we had yesterday. We started off with a discussion about gun violence and whether the fatality statistics back up the argument that shootings should be studied as a matter of public health. Should, say, labs at the CDC work to understand this problem better? Here are your first thoughts.
This is Mary D'Entremont from the mountains of Northeast Georgia. Very recently, up here in Clarksville, we lost our beloved mayor, longtime mayor, physician, Dr. Terry Green, amazing man, loved by all. We lost him to suicide by gun. He had a gun in his house. I don't know the details of the situation. Can't help but wonder if it had been more difficult for him to commit suicide if we would have lost him. I fully agree and support research on gun violence.
We also brought you the story of a man who, in a fight for his right to keep an image of himself with a colander on his head as his driver's license photo. He wants to have his driver's license photo included him wearing a colander. The man says he's a member of the Pastafarian religion, which is represented by the flying spaghetti monster, and the colander is a symbol of religious expression. But the Georgia Department of Driver Services disagrees, and they want him to retake his photo. Kelly Flakes sided with the state. Kelly wrote this on Facebook: "Flying Spaghetti Monster is an internet satire of religion, and this guy feels entitled to act like it's a real religion. Affluenza Kid felt entitled to act like an irresponsible twit and get away with it. Why are we allowing this attitude to persist? Where did this culture of get away with anything you can come from?" We always love to hear what you think. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk. You can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, where there is a pretty good discussion going about the flying spaghetti monster or whether or not Chris Avino should be allowed to keep the colander on his head. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. The city of Decatur, Georgia is getting whiter and richer. That's the conclusion of a diversity report that was commissioned by the city in 2014. The study found Decatur's African-American population has shrunk by 50% since 1990. That is huge. And there are some other significant changes also. The median income of white households increased by 10%, but it dropped for African-American households by 50% over the past decade. A decrease in diversity and a struggle for affordable housing is a growing concern for many Decatur residents. And Casey Yoder is the former public information officer for Decatur and co-authored this study. She joins us now. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Celeste.
Also with us is former Decatur Mayor Elizabeth Wilson, and she served in that position from 1993 to 1998. She now lives in Oakhurst, which is a neighborhood in Decatur that's seen the most drastic change. Elizabeth, good morning.
Good morning.
You told our producers, Elizabeth, that you get bags of letters of people offering to buy your house. Is that true?
All the time.
Why do you think that is?
Because the neighborhood is changing so rapidly. And I get them and some of my neighbors because we are the elderly population in the Oakhurst community. Our houses are equally aged, and so we have young people who want to move into the city of Decatur, and especially young parents because of the school system. And we have these developers who want to purchase the older homes like mine so that they can tear them down and build bigger houses to accommodate that population.
So, Casey, help me understand what you find of concern. Well, first of all, let's talk about some of the other things that you found in your study. We already mentioned that the African-American population has dropped by a huge amount. 50% is enormous. And their income, their average income has fallen by an enormous amount. And that the white population's income has increased. What else did you find in your study?
Well, the Oakhurst neighborhood where Miss Wilson lives is actually the neighborhood that saw the most dramatic change. So if you looked at the census data from 1990, that neighborhood, the city of Decatur, is actually only 4.5 square miles. And so the city divides pretty evenly into about four quadrants. So the Oakhurst quadrant back in 1990 was the poorest of the four census-designated areas. And as of the most recent census in 2010, it's actually seen the highest rise in incomes and is now one of the, you know, most of Decatur's wealthy.
Yeah.
But it's much wealthier than it's ever been in the past. So that's a dramatic change. And, you know, Ms. Wilson has seen it with her own eyes on her own block, as have many people who live in the city.
Elizabeth, have you seen also the demographics change? Have you seen African Americans moving out of that neighborhood, Oakhurst?
I have. I've seen population change. More than moving out, there are no African Americans moving in.
And we should mention that you are African American.
I am.
And have been all your life.
All of my life.
So, Casey, why is this of concern? I mean, everyone's interested in diversity, but for a town, why does it matter which kind of residents you have and whether or not the residents are wealthy, becoming wealthier?
Well, the community has said time and time again over the decades that one of the things they love about living in Decatur is that it is a diverse community. So there were strategic plans done in 2000 and 2010 that took input from the residents of the city at community roundtables and other public forums. And what people kept saying was, you know, we really love and we really value the difference of opinions and socioeconomic status and race. And, you know, you go down the list of diversity and people love it. And so much so that it was written into both the 2000 and 2010 strategic plans that a shared community value is to promote and encourage a diverse community. So this isn't a top-down thing. This is a bottom-up.
So what's causing the shrinking in diversity? And is it all demographics? In other words, are you seeing a commensurate rise in Asian Americans or Latinos in Decatur that kind of compensates for the loss of African Americans?
I don't think you see anything that compensates for the loss, but what I found very interesting when you look at the census data is back in 1990, there were really only two races that you could document in the city of Decatur, white and black. As of today, there's now enough of Asians, Latinos, Native Americans, that whole other racial
other category,
you know, racial minority, that you can actually see those numbers. They're starting to show up in significant numbers in the data. And the most interesting thing, in my opinion, is if you look at elementary school age children, that level of, you know, other racial minority is almost equal with the African American population in the city in that age group. So when I look at that, what I see is that people who are maybe in mixed race couples feel comfortable moving to Decatur and having their children live in the city.
So it's not all bad news.
It's not all bad news.
But Elizabeth, one of the things that has been an issue is that one of the reasons that many African Americans, as you say, are not moving in is because they're being priced out. Have you seen property values change?
Oh, absolutely. Property values is so so high at this time that very few people can afford to move into the city. And my example of this is when I purchased my house in 78, I paid $23,500. Today, if I sold my house, I would get at least a quarter of $1 million.
Wow. And have your taxes rises? Have your taxes?
The houses are selling in my neighborhood now, which is hard for me to believe, and I live here and I watch it every day. They are selling in like $1 million. I appeared before the commissioners one night to say, I've lived here long enough to see the full circle of Decatur in the housing pattern. And I did not move into Buckhead. That I'm living in a community where just the average of us could afford to move into and have the diverse community that we talk about. But that will not last because there will be that group that moves in who have the high income, who can pay the million or the 800 or 700,000.
Well, Casey, you know, I'm trying to think of how to word this. Many people, although you're talking about strategic plans, and they all say they value diversity. What we've seen in the United States is that while people often say they value diversity, the tendency is that even among people who consider themselves to be liberal, they vote with their feet and they often self-segregate. So how do you get, if Decatur's plan is to try to remain a very diverse community and you have people that will move to neighborhoods in which there are all people that look like themselves, how do you then achieve that?
That's the challenge.
Yeah.
You know, we live in a society with free market values and we all love that, and it's great, and it's wonderful, and you know, makes owning a small business wonderful in this country, and things like that. And so, it's a delicate balance. You know, Ms. Wilson talked about affordability is a huge issue, and so what you're seeing in Decatur is people of Ms. Wilson's generation who can't afford the property taxes anymore, and you're seeing people of my generation who can't afford to rent an apartment in the city, much less think about trying to buy a $1 million home.
Right.
So I know the city is really trying to look at ways to create more affordable housing as one way and one tool to try and address that.
Right. And one of the things that they're thinking of is the cottage court pilot project to try and build actual affordable housing. And you have hopes that that could work? Is affordable housing basically the solution?
I think it's one part of the solution. I think what you talked about with people will sometimes say one thing and do another, that's also, there's individual contributions that have to happen to this. We've got to keep talking about it. I think that's really important. You don't have one conversation about this issue and then that's it.
Ta-da.
You know, we have to keep talking about it. We have to keep trying solutions. The city government has a role to play. Individuals have a role to play. And community groups and organizations in the city all have a role to play to keep this at the forefront and important.
Casey Yoder is the former public information officer for the city of Decatur. Elizabeth Wilson is the former mayor. Elizabeth and Casey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is On Second Thought.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. The guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell.
David Duty is the superintendent of City Schools of Decatur. They currently have one high school course on computer programming. It's called Intro to Digital Technology, and he'd like to expand that. But there are a lot of questions before he can do that. Questions like, will students actually take these courses? Will other courses suffer because he's offering a more robust digital curriculum? And what does it all cost? David Duty is a former computer programmer himself, and he joins me now. Hi there.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. We're also joined by Cameron Wilson. He's the COO of Code.org. That is a nonprofit that works with states and school districts to expand computer science curriculums in K-12 schools. Hi, Cameron.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the chance to chat.
Can I start with that? You know, Cameron, the very first question I had when I started reading about schools trying to expand coding courses was, I bet this is expensive. How expensive is it? For example, not just how much do the courses cost, but what kind of computer do you need to supply to students in order for them to participate in a course like this?
That's a great question. First, I'd mention we're really trying to expand computer science courses versus coding courses. You know, we think of computer science as a really broad field that encompasses lots of different things beyond just coding. coding tends to be the rigorous part of computer science where you're actually creating the technology. And, you know, the costs that you bear as a school district are the technology costs, which you mentioned, potentially curriculum costs, potentially teacher costs. And what we've found in working with school districts across the country is that the technology costs are typically something that districts already have in place or already have thought through because they have technology labs and they can utilize those for the courses. And at Code.org, we're trying to remove the barriers around preparing teachers and curriculum instruction by offering open source curriculum for school districts and a learning platform that's open source as well, and then actually partnering with school districts to prepare the teachers to actually teach computer science courses. That's not to say there's no cost in those things for districts to support teachers with the infrastructure they need throughout the year and general support staff, but at least we're trying to remove these cost barriers from school districts.
David, let me play you a comment from Vernon Cole. He's a principal at Gould Elementary in Savannah, and they have done a number of what they call Hour of Code sessions in the past couple years. They bring in first through fifth graders, and he says the kids enjoy it, but it took time to convince the teachers.
There's a couple teachers that jumped right into it, but there were a lot that, you know, it's one more thing. How's this going to work out? You know, this really doesn't apply to us. And after getting into it and working with it, teachers were able to see the use and the value of this.
How do you find that in Decatur in terms of convincing teachers that this is worthwhile?
Yeah, you know, I think our teachers will be supportive of this when they understand the connections of coding to other areas. You know, there's a lot of logic involved in coding, for instance, and problem solving, and the whole idea of learning basically a different language. And I think that those are all things that they may be, we may be doing them through computers, but it's something that's growing the students intellectually, and I think that teachers, when they understand that, are more supportive of it.
How much does this cost? How much of an investment is it to add another computer science course?
Well, you know, it would be a question of where the resource is coming from, and so it would be something where when you have students taking these courses, then they're not taking different courses. And so in that terms, I'm not too worried about the cost. Obviously, there's some technology costs, like Mr. Wilson was talking about, with the making sure you have the devices that they can do the work on and those sorts of things. So it's really a question of when the students are interested in it, they start taking it, what are they not taking instead, and can we shift those resources from whatever that area was to this new area?
Okay, so Cameron, let me play you another comment. This is from Delta Hagen, a program specialist at the Georgia Department of Education. She actually is the one that deals with IT curriculum, and she says they've brought some new courses for state schools because that's something that the governor recommended. They've added three new courses for high school on game design and animation, embedded computing, that's embedded computing is computers talking to one another, and then also web development. But here she's talking about sort of the diversity. This is something you allude to, the diversity of courses you need.
The state of Georgia is very diverse from one end to the other. So a school in Southwest Georgia may not have the same needs as a school in the Metro Atlanta area or a school in Savannah because the industry that's located there is different. So we make these courses available for schools to offer if they need it in their area.
So this is, and help me understand, because you said that you've moved away from focusing solely on coding, but I thought that the focus on coding was because that's sort of the universal language, that's sort of an entry point.
It's an easy way to describe a computer science course that is robust and rigorous. A lot of curriculum that's within our existing schools is really focused on making sure students understand how to use technologies, and we call this sort of basic technology literacy, which is really important, but it often gets conflated with computer science. And we've been trying to focus students on making sure that they're getting exposed to computer science, and coding is a critical part of computer science that allows you to create the technologies, and that's the key difference. But we don't want to just stop with coding courses. We want to make sure that they're getting a broad exposure to computer science that includes lots of things, like understanding how the internet works, understanding fundamentally how security on the internet works, or how information is exchanged, or how information is encoded or compressed, how you can deal with data. And these all give students fundamental skills and knowledge that they can apply to almost any field. And that's why we talk about doing more than just coding courses in school, that we're actually trying to teach a broad set of computer science concepts.
David, these kind of courses would be an elective. Would they be voluntary?
Most likely. What I'd really like to see, we have a career center in City Schools of Decatur, and I'd really like to see this become one of our career pathways so they could get into those things that Mr. Wilson's talking about and get beyond the coding and talk more about the computer science throughout a series of courses.
Look, I have a teenager, and he's over with his friends all the time, and it's fine when you're talking about video gaming, but as soon as you say something like cybersecurity, the eyes basically roll back into the head. So how do you get kids to take these courses that might lead to a career in something rather than playing Call of Duty?
Sure. You know, I think it's like anything when we're working with students. You have to figure out how to tap into their passions, and I think you can use things like, for instance, my kids are very interested in Minecraft, and there are many things that we could be doing within Minecraft, for instance, we could teach them these concepts at a very young age without them even realizing that they're learning about cybersecurity or they're learning about how the internet works. And so I think it's a matter of tapping into those passions.
Minecraft, for those who don't know, is a game where you sort of build your own world and environment.
Correct.
And mine for gold and other things. If you don't have a kid that plays it, Minecraft may sound like something very odd.
Yeah, good point.
David Duty is the superintendent for the City Schools of Decatur. Cameron Wilson is the COO of Code.org. David and Cameron, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Associated Press reporter Kate Brumback recently got a very extensive tour of the Georgia Diagnostic and Classification Prison. That's a place that's about an hour and a half from Atlanta, and it's where thousands of Georgia's inmates rotate in to be assigned to one of the state's 31 prisons. And we wanted to know what that process looked like and how it went and how the state actually decides where prisoners will serve their sentences. So Kate is with us to talk about that story and what she saw. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Also, we have Kenneth Mantle. He's the Director of Offender Administration for the Georgia Department of Corrections. Welcome.
Good morning.
Kate, first of all, what led you? I mean, I don't think most people even think about how somebody goes to what different prison. So how did this even become a story for you?
I cover the Department of Corrections and prisons in Georgia, and I had the opportunity in October to go on a shortened tour of the prison in Jackson, which is the diagnostic and classification prison. And while I was there, I found it really interesting, and so I wanted to go get a deeper look. And I was really interested in that prison because it's where prisoners start. It's where they're classified and sent to other prisons in Georgia.
It's the entry point that
Yes.
everybody goes through.
Yes.
And then, Kenneth, if a prisoner goes to Jackson, and this is where they all come in, what happens when they're there?
So this process is once an offender has been sent to prison, once we accept that package, we send them for the mails. They go to Jackson, our diagnostic prison. Also, we call it GDCP. So once that mail reaches GDCP, they go through this classification process, which Ms. Kate did see. It averages about 2 weeks. So within about 14 days, we look at everything from the crime that they committed, the age that when they committed this crime. We look at medical issues that they may or may not have. We look at substance abuse issues. We look at mental health. We also look at vocational type programs, like does somebody have their GED or high school diploma? If they do not, then that's something that we can look at as far as placement at their next transfer. But all this goes into what we call our next generation assessment, our NGA tool. That will give us a risk of what that person needs. And then we take those needs and then we make the appropriate transfer.
So you have kind of classifications of each prison. I mean, not just prisoners, but each prison sort of has its own character, right? There are some that are kind of hardcore. I mean, is it true that you'll have sort of the blue-collar prisons and the white-collar prisons?
I wouldn't say that. It's each one is a little bit – we have all types of offenders in all our facilities, but we do have among our roughly 33 state prisons, we have everything.
Oh, 33.
Yes, ma'am. Two of them are kind of units, but we still call them state prisons. So 33 if we count those two. But we do have a close security prisons. We have our medium security prisons, and then we also have minimum security prisons. And so that's kind of like the levels that our inmates are as well. And so that's how we kind of break down our three classification for inmates. And so that's kind of how our prisons are kind of looked at, close and medium, basically.
So, Kate, there's actually been a number of issues and headlines about prisoners protesting what prison they've been put in. We've covered in here people talking about gender. There's been some trans inmates who've complained about being in the wrong place. And I wonder what you think about the rigorousness of how people are classified and what prison they go to. As far as you found, how rigorous is that diagnostic and classification program?
I'm not really sure I can address that. The visit I made to that prison was mostly just to observe what it was like in the prison, because it's a diagnostic prison, but it's also the prison where death row is. And so my purpose of going there was just to see, you know, it's kind of where everyone starts. And for this select group of inmates, it's where they end up as well, because it's also the prison where executions are carried out. I don't know that I have.
So it's a high security prison.
Parts of it are.
So when they come in there, where do they stay for the 2 weeks that Kenneth was talking about?
There are cell blocks and dormitories which are set up for
as a temporary place.
It is. It is temporary.
What surprised you when you walked in there? Was there anything that kind of you didn't expect?
I mean, I think the thing that struck me most was just how loud it is in the main part of the prison. I mean, you're walking through and there's metal gates that are clanking constantly, and you've got groups of inmates are just constantly moving from one place to another, and so you hear there's chatter of the inmates, there's guards telling them where to go, what to do, and then you've got the guards radios, and it's there's nothing soft to absorb
really
the sound, so it's really loud in there.
Kenneth, let me ask you that same question then, in terms of the rigorousness of what you go through. I mean, you said that there's all those kind of things that you consider, but how do you find those things out? If you're evaluating somebody's mental health, for example, how do you do that?
So our mental health professionals, our health services, we have outstanding doctors through partnerships with the Medical College of Georgia, or I guess Georgia Regents, as we would say. So our partnerships with our medical staff, we have great medical folks. We have great medical teams that evaluate. And again, a lot of that is caught through our NGA. So once they are evaluated, and we do look at a number of factors, but we also look at one, safety and security of all of our facilities, and not just the safety of our staff, but the safety of the inmate population as well. So if we see an inmate that potentially could be a victim of something, we do identify him, and we do, or her, depending on male or female or where we need to send them, and we identify those offenders, and then we again transfer them accordingly to make sure that they are in a safe environment.
Do they get reevaluated on a regular basis, or do you only reevaluate status or where they are when a problem arises?
No, we do. If they are on a mental health caseload, then there's set times when they need to meet with their counselor. But then if they're just on a general population, caseload, then, you know, every couple months, then they'll just be evaluated if they're just a straight general population inmate. But if they do have medical, or if they do have mental health or substance abuse needs, they are constantly being reevaluated.
One of the things that you saw when you were there, Kate, I understand, is what's called the sorting process. What did that look like?
I mean, When you say that, we saw where they come in and they are given a jumpsuit after they shower, and then they have their hair cut, and then they have
like
their
ID photo taken.
That
process that we often see on movies or TV shows where they come in and they hand them the folded clothes. Is that what you're talking about?
Sort of. But, I mean, it's more just they're going through, they're getting their hair cut, they're getting their ID photo taken, and then they walk into a big area that used to be a gym and it's been converted into a sorting area, and they're sitting in rows of benches and they're getting instructions, and around the edge of that are a bunch of small offices where there's counselors, there's medical professionals who talk to them and one by one and just kind of try to assess their needs. And so that's really what we saw.
Which sounds a little bit, Kenneth, we only have about a minute left, but that almost sounds like what you do when you get to a university. I'm not trying to be flippant. I mean, this is prison. But, you know, it's like everything's kind of all in a line and you go from station to station. Is that accurate?
It is. It's similar to when you enroll in school and all of a sudden you show up at your college campus and you're going from one table to the next. Very similar process. You're going to meet with medical. You're going to meet with your counselor. You're going to meet with parole staff. There's a number of folks that you're going to meet as you walk down the line.
And how many are we talking about? Is this a daily process?
It is a daily process. But as Kate mentioned in her article, on Tuesdays and Thursdays are our major transfer days. During that time, over 200 inmates could be at that facility. In a given year at Jackson, at our diagnostic facility, roughly about 14,000, 15,000 inmates on average go through that prison a year.
Has a lot of people to process through. Kenneth Mantle is the Director of Offender Administration for the Georgia Department of Corrections. Kate Brumbeck is a reporter for the Associated Press. It's a great piece. I recommend you read it. Kate and Kenneth, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have posted a link to Kate's article about the Georgia Diagnostic and Classification Prison at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. This is On Second Thought.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols.
The American chestnut once dominated hardwood forests from Maine to Florida, all through the Appalachians, but a terrible blight of fungus in the early 1900s forced the species into near extinction. Researchers now hope to bring the American chestnut back. Here to tell us more about that is Martin Cipollini. He's the science coordinator for the Georgia chapter of the American Chestnut Foundation and also a biology professor at Berry College. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning, Celeste. Nice to be with you.
And nice to be with you as well. Also with us is a man who wears a lot of different hats. He's played a keyboard with some of the greatest names in music, the Allman Brothers, the Rolling Stones, Eric Clapton. He's also a really passionate tree farmer and co-founded the Mother Nature Network. Chuck Lavelle, it's a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Celeste. Great to be with you. And I love your show. Listen to it as often as I can. Real pleasure to be with you.
Oh, that's very nice. I hope, Chuck, that you can introduce me first to the American chestnut and what makes this tree special.
Well, so many things. Beginning, let's say, with the chestnut themselves, you know, that are so important for wildlife or were important before the blight wiped them out. For wildlife and also for human consumption. I loved hearing the great Nat King Cole sing that song that we all know so well. But also the wood itself. The chestnut trees tended to grow a little bit faster than oak trees. The wood was revered for the high quality. As many of you know, it was used in furniture making, building homes, and so many other purposes. So this was just a great American icon.
So, Martin, tell me a little bit about this blight, this fungus that nearly wiped out American chestnuts completely. How many trees died in the early 1900s?
Well, estimates were, you know, that we had about 25% of our hardwoods being American chestnuts, and that amounted to something like 4 billion trees that were wiped out in the space.
4 billion with a B.
4 billion with a B, wiped out in the space of about 40 years. The blight started, where it was first recognized in the Bronx in New York, and then spread from there south. And by the 40s and 50s here in Georgia, it had gone through our trees and essentially killed all of the adult trees to the roots. Fortunately, the American chestnut can resprout from the roots. Otherwise, we may have no chestnuts whatsoever to attempt to breed blight resistance back into.
How many do we have? Do we have a good census on them?
Well, you know, it's an interesting problem because they're technically not endangered because we still have millions of trees out there. But the problem with this is they had been, as Chuck was alluding to, large, very productive forest trees. Now they exist primarily as small root sprouts that may or may not make it to reproductive stage. And so they're essentially ecologically extinct, even though there's still millions of them out there.
Chuck, how difficult is it to grow a chestnut? And do we know if this is the same chestnut that we're growing now that grew back in, say, 1905?
Well, let's get to the current research and technology that's being used. There's a number of things going on. First of all, the American Chestnut Foundation, a great organization for anybody that wants to look, acf.org. One of the things that has been done is breeding a 1/16th Chinese chestnut, which has the resistance to the blight. However, the Chinese chestnut is kind of a dwarf chestnut tree, a bushy thing. It's not like the great American chestnut that we're talking about. So they're breeding 1/16th of a Chinese chestnut with 15/16ths of an American chestnut is a very hopeful technology that is going on. I've planted about 30 of those trees on our place at Charlane Plantation, and so far they're doing quite good. I had a little bit of mortality. I think I might have lost 3 or 4 trees, but this was in the last 2 years I've been planting them, and the ones that are surviving seem to be doing very well. There's another technology using genome and blight-resistant transgenic technology where they insert a specific gene from wheat This is being done up at the State University of New York College of Environmental Science up in the Northeast. And in doing this, it breaks down the oxalic acid, which the fungus secretes in the cambium to the lower of the pH, and subsequently kills the plant tissue. So the chestnut trees, which contain this resistant gene, can be infected by the chestnut blight, but they are not girdled and they don't die. So this, a number of researches going on in various universities, and of course, again, by the American Chestnut Foundation.
So, Martin, what, I mean, the American chestnut is a huge tree. I've seen some of these pictures. They can, like, 10 feet in diameter and almost 100 feet tall, right?
Right. So they were fast-growing, and they would achieve great heights. But I guess the more important thing is that they were also uniformly productive. That is, oaks, again, as Chuck alluded to, those trees do something called massed seed production. So they produce a good nut crop every few years, whereas American chestnut, because of its late flowering, rarely affected by frost and that sort of thing, would produce a consistent, abundant nut crop every year. So wildlife and humans were highly dependent upon the tree for its nut production. So trees, you know, 8 to 10 feet in diameter, not uncommon, producing large amounts of nuts every year. You can imagine what a resource that was, particularly when 25% of the trees were those that species.
Yeah, I read a couple sort of appreciative recounts from the 1800s of the chestnut tree, and they described as there being so many of them that when they went into blossom, the blossoms are white, that it looked like the hills were snowy.
So, right. A lot of our mountains are called a white top mountain or something like that, and those that almost uniformly refers to the chestnuts at the top of the hills.
So, and as I understand it, this fungus that came in was actually brought in from Japan. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. So the Chinese or Asian chestnuts in general are resistant to the blight, and in turn they are carriers of the blight. And it's thought actually that the blight was first introduced to American chestnut from Japanese chestnuts that were imported for horticultural reasons. They had been doing this for many years prior to the blight being recognized, and in fact, it may not have started in the Bronx, as a lot of people think, but was introduced in several places through Japanese or Chinese chestnuts.
So, Chuck, what do you hope for, especially within the next 10 or 20 years? How many chestnuts can we grow and possibly replant?
Well, the ACF, again, the American Chestnut Foundation, has a goal of planting over 1 million chestnuts over the next 7 years. I think this is entirely doable, given the technologies that's being used and the progress that's being made. I think it's fantastic. And, you know, Celeste, when you think of look, our trees of all types face all kinds of challenges. You've heard about the emerald ash borer, the hemlock woolly adelgid. Of course, in the south, we have the southern pine beetle, the Ips beetle, the black gum turpentine beetle, and sudden oak death syndrome out in California and in the parts of the west. And then you have the mountain pine beetle that has decimated trees up in Canada and in the United States, some 50 million trees on both sides of the border. So to have a success story like what's happening with the American chestnut now is just so important, you know, that we can use these technologies and the breeding techniques to bring this great tree back. It's one of the most wonderful, magnificent things that one can imagine standing under. There's, as Martin has said, there's just a handful of trees scattered around. There was one article I read recently about a tree found in Lovell, Maine, that's about 115 feet tall, which is great to find a tree like this that is surviving. There's a, as I understand it, Martin may be able to expand upon this. I've never seen them myself, but a handful in Pine Mountain here in Georgia. Is that true,
yeah,
Martin? Have you ever seen those?
Yeah, our highest concentrations of American chestnuts in the state of Georgia are at Brasstown Bald area and then Pine Mountain, and scattered throughout our national forest areas, you can find them. But again, finding trees that are actually flowering, which is essential for the American Chestnut Foundation's breeding program, is a very difficult process. Working with our state chapter, we've been able to locate about 150 trees that are capable of producing flowers and nuts and burrs and that sort of thing. that's a little sprinkling of the genetic diversity that was out there. So,
and Martin, you've been concerned about the American chestnut, as I understand it, since you were a kid. Your father used to tell you about the death of the American chestnut?
Absolutely. I'm from Western Pennsylvania, a small coal mining town, and my father used to show me surviving American chestnuts. We would try to tend to them, you know, clear around them, coax them into flowering production, and get some nuts. And it just never worked for us. It was always a failed attempt and kind of disappointing. But I knew that all along. And then I tripped upon a meeting of the American Chestnut Foundation up in North Carolina about 10 years ago and found the progress that had been, you know, learned of the progress that is being made by the American Chestnut Foundation, and really was encouraged to join the new found chapter here in the state of Georgia.
Chuck, one of the things that the ACF asks is that when people see a chestnut in the wild, that they keep record of it, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Anyone that in this listening to this program, if you are aware of any chestnut trees, please call GPB or get in touch with the American Chestnut Foundation and give that report. We are constantly looking for trees that may be out there. And occasionally the successes are found, you know, again, like this recently, this one just found in Maine. So, you know, anybody that loves trees out there, be on the lookout.
Okay, so what am I looking for? How do I know when I'm looking at an American chestnut?
I'll let Martin address that. He's more well-versed in what to look for these days.
So I'm the person who gets the reports for the state of Georgia.
Oh, you do?
At Berry College. So, we often are chasing down reports of Chinese chestnuts. That's very common, but the first thing is in a wild area, a forested wild area, burrs on the ground. That's the thing that most people notice the first, you know, that find some burrs, spiny sea urchin-looking burrs on the ground. The leaves are long, slender, with very deep, curved teeth. The leaves are essentially hairless. The trees that are producing burrs are often already covered with cankers, blight cankers, and so finding a tree that is producing these burrs that's completely free of blight is usually an indication that it's a Chinese chestnut. But we have little cards and on our acf.org website, there are keys to identifying chestnuts. And that's something that the general public can definitely help us with.
Chuck, you have a tree farm just outside of Macon, correct?
That's right, yes.
How big is it?
We have about 3,000 acres, and of course, primarily concerned with southern yellow pine, and we've been involved in the restoration of longleaf pine on the place. As a matter of fact, this season we're planting about 120 acres of longleaf on the place. But I just found the chestnut tree so fascinating, and I want it to be a part of what we do at Charlane Plantation, and hopefully to encourage other tree farmers throughout our state and throughout the Southeast to engage in this.
Were there any chestnuts on your property or near it when you purchased it?
No, none whatsoever. You know, the one of my dear friends is former President Jimmy Carter, and we attended an ACF meeting together one year, and I remember him talking about when he was a child having one on, I think it was just one tree that they had in their place in Plains, Georgia, and that's really the only one that I've had any personal contact with someone that has had one on their property.
So, Martin, these trees that have survived in the forest, out in the, you know, unfertilized or cultivated, those are resistant? I mean, if something has survived for 100 years or so from the blight, does that mean they're resistant?
No. There's very little evidence that there's any real resistance. There's some tiny amounts of resistance coming from the American chestnut side. So unfortunately, it's just not enough to keep them alive. They may have cankers. They may have cankers that are somewhat less virulent, not because of the tree, but rather because of the fungus being a little weaker. And consequently, those trees may be able to survive a little longer than others, but there's very little resistance on the American side. And that's why we engage in either the back crossbreeding program that Chuck described, or the transgenic approach as well, to try to introduce blight-resistant genes into what are otherwise nearly pure American chestnuts.
And those crossbreeding of these trees is actually happening here in Georgia, correct?
Absolutely. For the last 10 years, I've been leading the bat crossbreeding program in Georgia, and we have orchards of all kinds all over the state, but we are just 10 years into this. The national organization has been working over 30 years, and we have at least that much time to go to complete our breeding program in the state. So we're really, we need partners. We need landowners interested in planting trees, forming long-term relationships to protect and study these trees during their development. So it's a big challenge that we in the Georgia chapter are very enthusiastic about, excited about, but we know it's a lot of hard work.
A million trees in 7 years, is that achievable?
Yeah, I think so. It's just a matter of this network of partnerships. And in fact, that's what the state chapter network is really all about. We have one national organization that's been working for 30 years, but each of the state chapters are, you know, started at various times in the past and are trying to capture the full genetic diversity of this tree. This is not, you know, producing a single nice lawn tree, right? This is about restoring a species to the wild. And so we're talking about chapters from Maine all the way through to Alabama working to try to capture the genetic diversity and produce trees.
Sorry, Martin, you're kind of breaking up a little there. That's Martin Cipollini.
Sure.
He's a biology professor at Berry College. He's also science coordinator for the Georgia chapter of the American Chestnut Foundation. And Chuck Lavelle, of course, a tree farmer and most recently keyboardist for the Rolling Stones. Chuck and Martin, thank you both so much.
Thanks, Celeste.
Thank you, Celeste. Great to be with you.
We're actually going to go out with one of Chuck's songs. This is called Back to the Woods. That's our show for today, but we want to hear about what kind of trees you have near your house. Certainly, if you see an American chestnut, call it in. But can you tell one tree from another? Well, tell us what's growing in your backyard or near your apartment. Call 404-500-9457. You can tweet us at OST Talk or post on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.
I woke up this morning and the clock was striking four. I woke up this morning and the clock was striking four.